This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you one of the surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com, where you will find a link to the live chat. The live chat is your go-to way to interact with other listeners or bring up points for discussion on the show, and this is especially important because we have a special guest on today. You can find our archived episodes not only at declinefm.com, but also on Decline to State on iTunes. And I am Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of Silicon Valley. And I'm joined by my handsome and at least one lovely co-casters. And I let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Hi guys, this is Eternal. Welcome to Decline to State.
This is Rado from the brains of the Silicon Valley.
Hi, this is Shiny, talking from sunny San Francisco. We rarely ever get to say that.
And as I mentioned, we do have a host on. I'm pleased to announce that we have Arini today. Arini is a prolific YouTuber, a blogger, and he even has a new novel that he's going to tell us about.
I'm very happy to be here. You guys have some cool intro music.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's the intro music is Language by Porter Robinson, and he has his stuff out there for free. He's an ANCAP, I guess, a dubstep techno guy. Not really my area of expertise in terms of music, but it's good stuff.
Oh, yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that, I guess it falls in the broader category of electronica, but one of the songs, Arini, that first caught the ANCAP's community's attention for him was he actually went and sampled Murray Rothbard for a song called The State, and he puts it into dubstep, and that was just mind-blowing to see a 19-year-old kid do that. So it kind of became the ANCAPistan national anthem for a year or so.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm absolutely blown away with the kids coming out of high school now. I mean, like 90% of them are idiots, but that 10%, like I look at these guys and I'm like, I wish I had that much figured out at that age. Like a lot of the guys that follow my channel, a lot of the guys I chat with on YouTube, I'm just blown away by how these kids are taking advantage of the internet to actually look up primary sources, to go learn something that they're never going to be taught in the mainstream. And I'm just really, really impressed with these millennials, I gotta say.
Well, yeah. I have a question for you, Arini. And this is the standard question we ask to every single guest that comes here. And you're free to respond however you want. Do you decline to state?
You know what? In its present form, absolutely. You know what? Like, I'll say this. If we could go back 100 years, I probably wouldn't have too much problem with the government. If we could go back 200 years, 300 years, you know, I'd be a loyal servant to Her Majesty, because that was a pretty, you know, not everything was perfect, but it was an okay state of affairs. This present madness we have, I think it speaks for itself.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned Her Majesty, because you know there was a revolution that was fought many, many years ago by the colonists that once stood where I stand, and you know they revolted over what, like a 1% tax increase on stamps or something. If they could see what we pay now to the central government, it's completely mind blowing. So just put it into historical perspective. We're at a place we've never been before, ever, in the history of this country, or the history of really Western civilization.
Well, maybe the fall of Rome.
Yeah, that's very true.
So if a person from back then were transplanted here and say, you know, we say to him, yeah, we pay like 60% taxes, all, you know, all things considered, he would be outraged. But if a person from that day was actually born now, he would probably say, no, you have to, you know, pay your taxes and stuff because you have to contribute to society and stuff, right? It's crazy.
Oh, people can't look beyond their historical perspective. You know, I was talking to somebody once. This is going way back. There used to be this thing called the advice board on the Tucker Max message board. And this one guy was talking about how he grew up with an abusive family and et cetera. And I was saying to him, here's the thing, dude. We all grow up in a quote-unquote normal household. Normal for you is the household you grow up in. So if you grow up with psychotic abusive parents, that's normal. So you seek out psychotic abusive relationships. But to extend this to politics, like, that's the thing, is of course we're at the end of history. Of course we live in the normal era. Of course you should take the blue pill and stay inside the matrix. Every era of history has been like that. There's this arrogance that we know everything. It takes a truly inquisitive mind to actually start looking and try and put yourself in a medieval peasant's perspective. What does he think? You know, put yourself 100 years ago. What do these people think? And actually look at it. Open your mind to different perspectives on reality.
Hmm. Interesting. So, I hear you wrote a book, and I've actually heard from 3 different people that the book, so far, is looking pretty good. Please, I'd love if you could tell us about the book.
I'd absolutely love to. The book is As I Walk These Broken Roads. It's post-apocalyptic science fiction, which is really, it's kind of the cowboy genre, it's the knights in shining armor genre. But both of those, like, knights in shining armor is, you're going to go back to Tolkien, it's going to be about the magical MacGuffin, it's going to be about the soul, about, like, the Christian narrative of self-sacrifice to save, you know, the humanity. You go to the cowboy genre, it's going to be set during the Revolutionary War in the United States. It's going to have specific revenge motives are going to be critical to the plot. And then you get the post-apocalyptic, which is set in a future, so you can do whatever you want with the future, essentially. But the common thread throughout all of these is it's about a protagonist that, A, has the skills and ability to survive, and B, is not encumbered by society's rules. And I think that's why I love the genre. And I think that's why the listeners to this program, to the people that read my blog, I think that's why they'll like it. Because we're not people that are screaming and crying for a social safety net. Like the idea of, you know, jumping on a horse and taking our dog and our rifle and just wandering out into the wilderness somewhere, that's something that's kind of sexy to all of us, something that we'd all love to do. Even though it would be rough, we know it would be difficult. It's kind of a relief to get away from society, the human resources, the politically correct speech, and actually enter a life or death scenario where we're challenged. And so that's why people will like, the listeners here will like the book. I'm pretty sure Barack Obama would hate it.
I probably will like it then. Sounds good. I wanted to interject because it sounds kind of like, I'm a big fan of the show Firefly, and I was wondering if it had kind of the similar flair, which is this idea of a guy who's in this kind of westernized, you know, this pseudo science fiction westernized society. When I say western, I mean like old western society, where he has to kind of live outside the law to get things done, and he's okay with doing that, but he still has a moral compass. Is that the kind of theme you're going for? Would that be a good parallel to an extent?
It's very, very similar. It's now this book focuses on two main characters. One is a soldier, the other is a mechanic. And both of them are intellectuals, fundamentally. And they kind of arrived at the truth through different paths. So they meet up and they see eye to eye on things. They both took the red pill from their respective societies. And now they're just trying to survive in a world where everybody has their own blue pill. If I can overuse the Matrix analogy there.
You can never overuse the Matrix analogy.
And they, now I'd like to emphasize too, one of my worries about the book is that Christians are going to be offended by it, because the protagonist is particularly anti-Christian. But that's one of the things. These characters are not me, okay? They're not shouting out my specific identifiable political beliefs. They're characters exploring reality, and they haven't taken the perfect red pill yet. That's kind of what they're doing, is as they advance, is figuring out more and more about how do you understand reality, how do you break away from what we've been taught our whole lives, and actually address reality head on. And yeah, they're basically cowboys and bounty hunters.
So what I find it, you know, I find it very appealing to jump into, not a horse, but my Trans Am and going to the sunset. I have to say, I would have to wait until the word, you know, changes a little bit so I can safely do that and really not care about the law, right? So we're still a few years away from that point where we can actually do that. And while we all welcome that, as long as it's not violent, it'll still take a little while to, you know, for it to happen. I wanted to ask you a question, and maybe later I'll give you a couple of questions from the audience, which are actually kind of interesting. I didn't think of them, and I want to ask them to you. So tell me something. How did you get into writing?
Yeah, that's such a weird question. Here's the funny thing. I always wanted to be a writer, but I could never come up with ideas. I remember I read this science fiction book back in high school that had been written by like a 16 or a 17-year-old, and as I recall, it was pretty good. It was probably very derivative, but it was well-written, it was readable, it was entertaining, which is, I'd like to say, number one rule of fiction is it has to be entertaining. And then, I guess it all started. I was visiting family back in Alberta. I was living in Ontario at the time, and I had a flight scheduled for the next morning, and me and my buddy were kind of screwing around. We had folks had an old furnace that they'd taken out, they'd replaced it. And so me and my buddy, he had a $20 pickup. We volunteered to get rid of it for him. So we we tied the old furnace to a piece of rope and drove up and down some 4x4 trails, dragging it behind us, just breaking it to pieces. And then he started ramming it with his truck. Then he rammed it too hard, it went over, and he popped a tire. And his $20 pickup truck did not have a spare tire. And so we had to make our way, I think it was about over 100 kilometers, back to his hometown. He asked me if I could drive stick. At the time, I didn't have a license. I was like, well, in theory, I can drive stick. And the night went completely foobar. It went completely pear-shaped, and we both just dealt with it. And it just struck me that, like me and this guy, like, we, when things go foobar, we're happy. We're okay. We didn't freak out. We didn't start crying. We didn't start yelling at each other. He said, well, things are broken. Things are messed up. How can we fix it? Walk 80 kilometers? Maybe thumb a ride? Well, I guess that's what we're doing then. And so that was kind of the inspiration for the book. And then, you know, my military experience went into it, and a lot of political philosophy, philosophy of knowledge. And it just kind of amalgamated into this huge story. This is the first book in a series. For the record, I promise it's not going to be a 16-book series and I die before I finish it or any nonsense. Like, this series needs to be written. I'm getting too old to write this.
Good.
But that's kind of where it came from, is that, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, that I do a lot better when everything, and if you'll forgive the blue language, as a master corporal of mine once said, when everything goes to the fuck, I like that. I can deal with that, as opposed to filing the TPS reports every day.
Sounds a little Fight Club-esque.
It is. I love that movie. I love Polanyiuk. It's not as extreme and metaphysical as that. It's an adventure story. It's set in the real world, but more or less. The technology, if you really know about the technology, is a little bit BS.
That's like all science fiction, though.
Oh, yeah. We were chatting before the show. You also work in RF communications, right?
I have experience in RF communications. I'm an electrical engineer. I have some background in RF communications.
Okay.
But I'm doing more software stuff now, but it's, you know, I certainly can do that stuff. So yeah, I have background in it.
Rebuilding the cell networks is a major plot point later in the series, and the technology used is 90% BS. 10% kernel of truth, but...
That's the key to good sci-fi, is you have something that's like somewhat rooted in reality, but you let your imaginations kind of go wild, and you know, it's like, you know, as you say, 90% BS and 10% pretty spot on.
Exactly. That's a major premise of the series. It's like rediscovering the technology. But to be perfectly frank, two guys with some outdated manuals do not rediscover how to rebuild a cellular network. It's bloody, bloody complex. So that's a little bit of cheating right there. But
I could probably get together with like a couple other people and get one tower and a couple of phones together. That would be about it. If it was like the old school phones, you know, you know what I'm talking about. The old phones are like the flip phones where you flip it up and there's numbers. You don't even get a keypad or anything.
Oh god, no camera. I have one of those. I thought you were talking about the brick phones. They just turned those off 3 years ago in this country.
Oh,
they were great phones. They made calls.
I think they only had 70 customers left.
I would have been one of them.
You know what? These AMPS phones, for some reason, they dropped fewer calls. Now it's all software. It's more complicated. And while I grant you, it's not possible for a person to just discover the whole thing and redo the whole thing on its own, we do have pretty good open source software that allows actually allows you to set up a cell phone tower that is completely outside, or a cell phone tower network that is completely outside of any phone company today, and run
with
the
3G.
Network with 3G. Yes, it's 3G. It's well studied, and you can download the software. So if you have the software, you probably need to read a few books, but you can actually pull it off. So I'm pretty sure it makes it very believable.
In fact, at the conference DEF CON, they set up their own cell network every time so that people can mess around and hack each other's phones on it. Of course, that's done with existing and functioning hardware, but the setup is all done by them on the spot.
You know, it's funny. I've always been more of a... Back in the day, I used to be a big computer guy. And nowadays, I'm not running Linux because it's an HP computer, and HP's a horrible company. But, you know, I love Linux. I love Fedora because it's the worst form of Linux, and Fedora's a cool word. But I'm completely out of touch. Like, touch screen messes with my head. I'm out of touch with the new cool technology. I like the stuff that doesn't work very well, that you have to spend an hour fixing every day.
Don't worry. You can do that with an Android phone.
I had one until it fell into a cup of coffee. I loved it.
Android flavored coffee. Oh my god.
I drink it. I love all types of coffee, but that one sounds like good coffee.
Which version is it? Was it gingerbread? Because I think that would taste good.
At this point, I have no idea. It's actually everything's good for the hard drive. I just need to figure out how to reinstall that. And I'll have a cool phone again instead of my broken flip phone. And I can show off to girls in bars with it.
So I just got one of those fancy pants smartphones because I also just got one of these things called a job, and it pays me money. So instead of working for random people, you know, this big organization called a university for free, I actually get paid to do that same kind of work. It's kind of
highly
cool.
Highly overrated having a job.
I actually really enjoy. I work for a really small company. It's a good experience so far.
Create value, it should not be a problem.
I agree. I think the most important thing, and this is something I just wanted to say a couple words on, because I know you're talking about how evil and horrible HP is. I think people these days seem to have a very skewed understanding of like jobs and capitalism and how the whole thing's supposed to work, because they see large corporations, that's where they go and apply for jobs, and they just see people bitching incessantly about how awful their grind, 9-to-5 grind is at these big, there's a word for it, very impersonal places.
HR, I mean, just, nightmare.
Yeah.
Roboticized.
Roboticized is a very good word.
Yeah, that's the sad thing that the last company I was working for is that it was a small company, but the sons had inherited it from their father, and, you know, they got MBAs and they play golf. And so they had this, they were trying to be a big corporation, and the job was awesome. You know, I'm out in the middle of nowhere driving a truck, setting up communication networks. Then you go back to the office, and suddenly it's politics central, which you normally don't get at the small companies.
That's true.
Not at all.
The bigger the company, the harder it is. So going back to your book, and actually, let me say this, you have quite a few fans in the IRC channel, and they love you. So they all want to hear about your book. And actually, personally, I would love to hear about your book again. Can you share with us a passage from the book?
You know what? I'd love to. This actually... The book has really awesome action scenes, and that's not just me saying that. This has been critiqued from very mean people, and they like the actions. I'm very proud of the action. But this will kind of give you the sense of what the book is about. So I'll launch into it. That's what I was getting at, Rex, is that we, all of us, have opened Pandora's box. We're paying the cost, but because of the war, we've lost the agency. We've got all the tech, knowledge, and wisdom, but we're living in the state of nature, like savages. We'll never get it back. Because we've fallen too far behind. It's hard as people without tech just to maintain our tech, and nothing's left over to go forward. We can't be moral because we're not free. We've got no choice. All we've got is necessity. Paused to suck up a cigarette. We're blinded wise men wandering along broken roads past decaying ruins. Our throats have betrayed us, and we can't tell our tales. Our hands tremble when we try and write them down. Our memories have failed, and our exploits have become meaningless. All the solutions, but we've forgotten them. We're intimately familiar with the primitive struggle to survive. Unlike him, we've got the wisdom to fully appreciate it. We've got the wisdom, but no means to emancipate ourselves. Side. That's what I meant by greater appreciation for tragedy. That's the quote.
That's pretty good. You know what? You make a very, very, very poignant point. We can't be moral if we can't choose. I mean, sure, we could be moral between quotes. I'm going to put that between quotes. We can be moral if the choice we get is, again, between quotes, moral. That is to say, not ethics, but imposed on you by some higher authority. But you can't really be moral if you don't have a choice, right?
You know what? This is why I love Death of the Author, by the way. Death of the Author means that however you interpret the book is accurate. Because that's, I was talking about how the Third World War pushed people back to the point where they, you know, the technology's dying, da, da, da. You're talking about communism. That, exactly. That if our whole life is pre-planned for us, if everything's set up with a social, like this extreme social safety net that we're all tied into this social spider safety net. Yeah, yeah. Like there's no moral realization in life. There's no moral reason to live. All you do, like you go to the club and grind genitals against somebody else, and that's your meaning, the meaning of your life in the perfect communist utopia.
And now, to be fair, I would totally go to the club and grind genitals with like Ronald McPaul because that sounds pretty hot. But I no, you're totally correct in that we really don't have a huge, when there is no choice. We take away meaning, we take away purpose, and we take away the ability for the person to discover things about themselves as an individual, because, you know, rather than them going on what we consider a self-knowledge, self-discovery, they just, you know, take whatever's pre-planned out to them by society, the state, whatever.
And all of this involves struggle. Like, I was talking with Jack Donovan about a week or so back. If you don't mind, he wrote the book The Way of Men, which is an amazing book. But we are not bonobos, okay, that go around just mating constantly. We are chimpanzees, and struggle is critical to our spiritual well-being. We need something to challenge us, and we don't want the masturbation society.
Yeah, you know, I actually wonder about that a little bit. Like, I've read some things you said, and I've seen a lot of videos you talk about different personality types. And, you know, the different desires that the people naturally have because they fall into those personality types. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that and whether you think some people are more comfortable and naturally okay with such a society where they're taken care of and where there aren't as many choices versus other personality types, like, you know, that are more individualistic. Is there some correlations there you want to talk about?
I don't know if there's a major correlation to personality types. Personality types. I follow the four vitreous humors, which is, you know, supposedly discredited by modern psychology, but I don't have much respect for modern psychology. Like, they tend to fall into different roles in an organization. Like, each one is more comfortable fulfilling a particular role. If I could quote a friend of mine, Asymmetrical Warfare, he says he's been forced to take the leadership position before because he was the most competent. But he really hates being in that position. Whereas, like myself, I am most comfortable in the leadership position, and I hate doing the, for instance, filing my taxes. I'm terrible at them. Okay, the minutiae, I'm just terrible at. Whereas he's amazing at it. So I wouldn't say that there's inherently a attraction of different personality types, the different society, looking at it from the four humors perspective. Although there definitely are. I'd say genetically that some people are more predisposed to, for instance, the R-type reproductive pattern as opposed to the K-type reproductive pattern.
So now that you say that, it reminds me of a bunch of competing theories, but it's pretty much well accepted that K-type versus R-type species, societies, subgroups of society actually do constitute a very, very faithful representation of how people behave and what their values are related to their, you know, sexuality and hunger being a huge driver for humanity. They actually do have a very, very strong correlation in values. Which one do you prefer, though?
Oh, well, I'm absolutely K-type. It's actually really striking when you see, like, they've done these mass studies actually linking political ideology to brain morphology. And it's really striking. Like, it's only a slight difference, but it's such an amazingly consistent difference that you can't ignore it. And so the R-type is... Well, and this is why liberals hate it. The R-type is generally considered the degenerate species. Basically, it's rich environment, lots of resources. So the strategy is have as many babies as possible. Don't invest in raising them. And so that's definitely like the liberal thing, you know, early sexuality with children, lose your virginity early, have lots of sex partners. And they use prophylactics, but that's actually because they don't want to invest in children. Whereas the people that lean towards the right wing tend to want children, tend to want more meaningful sexual relationships as opposed to just a string of one-night stands, and generally advocate caution about the whole thing. And when they do have kids, they usually want to invest in the children. Of course, we're in a really weird environment because we have, you know, prophylactics and we have no predators and... We have so many resources that we can afford to give a ton of free stuff to people.
I wouldn't say we have no predators. I think the biggest predators are, of course, going to be other human beings.
Politicians.
among them.
You know, I don't subscribe personally to the cabal of evil bastards that want us all to die. It's a very, very tempting hypothesis. Certainly looks like it's true.
I have something to suggest. I'm going to suggest you. You should read a book called The Authoritarians. I suggested this last week, so people are going to grill me, you know, for suggesting it again. It is a book that explains how these people are actually predators without wanting to be predators. It is a book that will tell you the mindset and explain the sociological and psychological raisons d'être behind what they do, right? In such a way that it's absolutely, I agree with you completely. It's not like they are, you know, this cabal of people that are trying to, you know, destroy the world. But through their actions, they are, most of them are destroying the world piece by piece. Like, the world is a really resilient thing to destroy. But if you go piece by piece, you can dismantle it if all you want is to take pieces for you, right?
Oh, so, God, it's like, look, I'm sure we've all seen Idiocracy. If you haven't, it's either a hilarious movie or depressing. Like we have intelligent people aren't breeding anymore. We're indoctrinating these young girls that they need to pursue sex the same way boys do. And like, you can look at the studies that there's a very strong correlation between female promiscuity and mental illness, that having too many partners does not make, like, having a lot of sexual partners as a man, you know, it's not as good as having a wife, but it feels okay. A girl that spends her 20s just sleeping with one asshole after another is not very happy at the time she's 30. But that's what we tell people to do through TV and media.
It's cultural.
It's downright genocidal, the policies that are being advocated. I mean, look at our birth rates in the West.
It's interesting that I wanted to talk a bit about the birth rate thing. How it relates to, of course, the state and state policies, and how we have an interesting dichotomy with what I guess you would call the R and K type populations, which is, as societies seem, and we see this across all modern societies, as they grow wealthier, birth rates decline. India's birth rate is going down, for instance. I mean, societies simply have less kids when there's more resources available, which is interesting because, you know, that's kind of the backwards of, you know, that I guess the R-type mass reproduction when there's tons of resources available type of approach. But then
I read an explanation for that. I wish I'd come up with myself, and I can't say if it's true or not. So you can hear it, decide for yourself. But a huge part of our estimation of whether or not we're wealthy is by comparing our wealth to others. So if we all live in the jungle, we all live in the exact same mud hut, and we're all equally wealthy. As opposed to nowadays, you know, like my parents have a ridiculous amount of wealth compared to myself. I'm sure it's the way with most young people now. Your parents are very wealthy. You are struggling to pay your bills. And so you feel like you're very poor, even though you've got this hard drive full of music, you've got a smartphone, you've got TV. I mean, like, good luck. I have a very nicely furnished apartment, just because furniture is so abundant nowadays that I didn't actually have to pay for any of it. So we feel like we're poor compared to everybody else, making the K-types feel like they're in the scarce environment. Whereas the R-types, collecting government welfare, or, you know, and they all live in the ghetto, they only hang out with ghetto people, they feel just as wealthy as everybody else, and they're not afraid of starving. Whereas we're like, how am I going to pay my phone bill next month? So we feel poor.
I think a lot of the reasons, you know, we've noticed that over the last, oh, I guess like 50 years, especially 50, 60 years, really since, you know, the end of World War II, we've seen this degeneration of what we would call, I guess, the middle class into, you know, away from, you know, one parent working, one parent staying at home, the traditional, you know, you start in the 50s with the idyllic family that, you know, is portrayed in a lot of TV back then and stuff. And you get to now, which is both parents are working. They don't know how the hell they're supposed to afford college, much less ever afford to move into a bigger home, because they're stuck in this home now that they've spent, you know, what, several hundred thousand dollars on a mortgage that they'll never be able to get that value back for because the housing market crashed and this and that. So you get this kind of draining of wealth from the middle class by the state, and it seems to get pumped in two directions. It seems to get pumped up, you know, to the rich and the wealthy, those who control the banks, the big corporations, the politicians and their, you know, unions and things where, of course, they're going to extract money that's freshly printed off the printing press from the Fed and are going to extract it from taxes. And then they redistribute it down, some of it, back to the lower classes so that they can feel comfortable to reproduce and, you know, go on existing in what you've described as the pretty typical, I guess, R-type lifestyle. And it seems to skew the demographics away from K-type towards R-type. And I wonder if that there's a reason for that, you know, whether, you know, conscious or unconscious, which is that I guess R-type people might be easier to control or at least are more beneficial to a state society. Any
thoughts
on that?
If we're gonna go with the conspiracy angle for a moment, let's say we all believe in the conspiracy. We're taking the middle class, the red-blooded American male, the guys that know how to change their own oil, that can program their own computer, that can take care of things. Like you don't need help from the state. You can take care of yourself. You need the state to leave you alone. You need a gun and a decent processor, and you're a happy, happy man. These are the people that are being attacked, and like it's more and more difficult to be in that middle class. Now, the proles, the underclass, are right now being handed all these freebies, but they're also being locked up in prison at tremendous rates.
Oh, that's very true. We have the highest prison rate of any nation on the planet, including like China, and it's like all drug crimes too.
Oh yeah, BS crimes. I mean, like, not that those guys, like most of those guys are, put it bluntly, they're probably assholes in real life. I don't think either you or I would like to hang out with them, but they're being prosecuted for BS crimes. And I actually read, this is scary. If the intelligentsia of the United States, like, it's very close to doing a complete 180 on race. Whereas right now, if you even mention race, then you're like some sort of horrible person that hates everybody and wants to like reenact the Holocaust. But it's actually very close to going from that to murder all the black people. And so if you've created this underclass that's, and like you encourage all the social ills. I mean, if you look at the black community in the United States 50 years ago, they were a lot happier and a lot healthier and a lot wealthier than today.
Families, the biggest thing I want to interject, because this is a huge point that I think people aren't aware of, which is that black divorce rates in the 40s were the same or better than white divorce rates. Black families were stronger than white families. Today, God forbid, I mean, what is 50% of black youth don't have jobs. I mean, they can't get educated. It's all single family homes. Yeah, continue.
And you see the same thing happening 20 years later in the white prole communities. Fishtown, it was mentioned, I don't remember the title of the book, but you see, like, Fishtown is this one place that's full of the white proletariat, and it's turning into the black ghetto 20 years after the black ghetto first appears. So, like, let's pretend you're a genocidal, psychotic monster that worships Satan. But that's perfect. You've taken the middle class and sucked all the vitality out of them, and the underclass you've turned into a bunch of rampaging monsters that are barely contained, and you're just ready for the excuse to go exterminate all of them. Meanwhile, yeah, this is why I'm a critic of capitalism, even though, like, me and Aaron Clary, I consider him a friend. Gonna motorcycle with him one of these days. Capitalism, Austrian economics, is brilliant, but pure capitalism tends to celebrate the narcissists and the sociopaths, and these are the bastards that rise to the top. It's not the cream that rises up, it's the bastards rise to the top, and they sell us hamburgers and Britney Spears.
I mean, in a sense, I mean, I think we see that today, and no one's going to deny that, you know, the people that are control corporations are going to be the same, you know, kind of psychopaths that you see, you know, with control of governments and the kinds of people that like to spoon feed the masses crap and keep them complacent. And they love power, obviously. They love being able to spoon feed shit to everybody and then everybody gobble it up. They love it. But I think that it's very easy to say to use the word capitalism. A lot of people use it to mean what we have today. What we have today is not capitalism. What we have today is like fascism. It's corporatism. It's not capitalism in at least the free market Austrian sense. So I know at least a lot of listeners probably very confused when you say that. You know, it's one of those terms that has a lot of hidden meaning. So I want to be very specific. When you say capitalism, what specifically are you referring to?
You know what? Capitalism as like this guiding ideology, and you know what? I'm going to use Ayn Rand as an example, and I love Atlas Shrugged. We were talking about before the show how I love her villains. Some people think her villains are facile, but honest to God, if you scrape the skin of a socialist, you see an Ayn Rand villain. They are full of that envy and the hatred of those that are better than them, and this vile black skiness. So I love her for that. But at the same time, if you look at Ayn Rand's personal life, or you know what, just look at Atlas Shrugged and look at how Dagny Taggart greets the men that fall in love with her. She just bounces from one to another with no regard for their emotions, with this perfect celebration of selfishness is the way to live.
I always felt like that interaction was very unrealistic and robotic. That's the one part of the book that I didn't like, is the whole romantic side to things, where she would like sleep with, I'm gonna give spoilers, so I hope you guys have read the book.
Why haven't you read the book? Read the book.
It'll only take you 2 years.
Yeah, skip the 80-page John speech.
Yeah, I'll summarize it up. It's called Atlas Shrugged. You read the rest of the book. But yeah, you can go and you can see, you know, the characters, the male characters, seem to just recoil from, you know, the breakups and the romantic excursions that Dagny goes on without any emotional repercussion. They're perfectly cool with it. They're like, oh,
yeah, they treat
he's a cool
it like
guy, I guess. That's all right.
They treat it like a business relationship where, well, I guess she decided to contract from that supplier instead.
That's not how people think. I mean, that's how maybe a psychopath thinks like that. I don't know, but it's not how normal people think.
Well, and if you look at Anne's personal life, that's exactly how she treated men, and she ended up splitting the whole objectivist movement. But that's what I'm kind of saying about capitalism, is that you need, like, underneath, like, we need a bigger meaning in life than collecting as much money as possible. And now the best way to be a healthy, like, the best way to be successful and, you know, have food on the table, etc., is Austrian economics. But money is there to enable us do things that really matter, to have family members that we love, to raise a family, to be a good, decent person. Whereas pure capitalism tends to kind of result in that Ayn Rand, everybody's a tradable commodity, which then morphs into socialism. And
What you're saying is capitalism kind of breeds socialism at a cultural level. If I'm not, is this grabbing kind of the quick explanation of what you're getting at?
Yes, I think they're two halves of the same coin. Like, both capitalism and socialism, they only look at the individual as a dollar sign or a bank account. You know,
I understand that, yeah. You see a lot of celebrations of money, value, profit in terms of the economic sense, and people seem to overlook. And I wouldn't say this is necessarily, you know, criticism of capitalism. I would extend capitalism to be things which are non-tangible pleasures, things like leisure, art, family, anything we value, I consider to be kind of part of the whole economic sphere, and capitalism does apply to Austrian economics, does apply to it, but most people don't see it that way. I understand your criticism.
Yeah, capitalism is probably, I'm going to say probably, because I don't know everything, I'm not Doctor Who. Capitalism is probably the best way to organize ourselves, but it's not a principle. Follow. Like, we should have some other principle that we're trying to live for, you know, whether like it be like freedom, the celebration of freedom, or the celebration of the development of the soul, or some some purpose for us being on this planet. And then once we have this purpose, then you have capitalism on top of that. And that's how you make sure that the purpose works really effectively. Does that make sense?
I think it does. To me, it does. Can I ask you two questions?
Absolutely.
So the first question that I wanted to ask you is actually from the audience. And they want you to talk about how politically correct, okay, I can feel your blood boiling right now, politically correct the word bully has become. And the second question that I wanted to ask you is, can you define freedom for us?
Yeah, sorry, could you, what was the first question again? You broke up just a little bit there.
Yeah, I have audio troubles. Well, it's not a Decline to State show without technical issues. So
it's not the internet without technical issues.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you the first question, and it is actually an audience question. People on the chat want to know, I want to actually hear you talk about how the word bully has become so politically correct.
Bully. Okay. Yeah, bully. Oh, good Lord. This is, I actually woke up this morning to the conservative talk radio station that's on my alarm clock talking about this bullying. And he's talking to this police computer forensic creep. These guys that tracks everything they say on the internet and finds hate speech in it. Or you look at a picture of a 17-year-old. We're going to lock you up for 16 years. Like one of these weirdos talking about bullying. Because there's some girl in BC that recently committed suicide because of online bullying. And I just wanted to scream at the radio. And like the problem is not a lack of monitoring. The problem is a lack of culture. That we've beaten down like all the masculine men. Masculine men are not actually violent. They're no more likely to initiate violence than a non-masculine man. But what they are more likely to do is punish somebody that breaks the rules. So a masculine man, when they see somebody breaking the rules, cheating, or picking on somebody that doesn't deserve it, masculine men are the ones that are going to go do something about it. And we've spent the past 20 years just beating those guys and giving them to Ritalin. And we have the like, you know, 50 years ago, the captain of the football team was a pretty cool guy, became a leader of industry, et cetera, et cetera. Nowadays, for all you high school students out there, guys that just recently graduated, your captain of the football team is a drug addict that abuses women, uses women, probably picked on you quite a bit. We've elevated the basest elements of masculinity. And so bullying now, but the problem with bullying is too much intervention, too much of the state punishing people for acting like human beings instead of acting like bloody drones.
Wait, sorry to interrupt you. Can you define bullying? Because there's like five different definitions of bullying, and I think that the name of the game in the use of a word is to actually control what the word supposedly means. Can you define it so we can understand you better?
Well, bullying, you know what? It's when you get picked on, when you get isolated from a group that you don't fit in because you're the new kid or because you're a little bit different. And the whole group just turns on you. And I suppose there's two different definitions. So that's what you find in high school. That you don't fit in because of whatever. You like math. You like reading books. You're not into the latest music. You're a little bit different, so everybody attacks you as an outsider. It's a prison situation where they attack you to look strong because they're all terrified of looking weak. As opposed to hazing, which, you know, the extreme form of hazing is if you join a military unit and you whine all the time and you're incompetent and you don't try hard and you rat people out and you're disloyal to the group, they'll make your life hell because you're a threat to them. They don't want you to be a part of them. But if you go away, they'll leave you alone. As opposed to the bullying, the high school prison style bullying, it's just this brutal, cruel torture of somebody so that you don't look weak. That's how I define it.
So I was asking this so I could understand you. I could actually understand what you were saying in context. Can you go back to what you were saying? I'm actually interested in hearing that.
Okay, it's basically, see, bullying comes out of weakness. You know, it's like some of these cops, I live in a city with bad cops, like they're excited and proud to hand out speeding tickets or BS parking tickets or just mess with people.
Now, Rini, we don't want to you know, talk bad about cops, because, you know, we don't want to make, like, the 1% of good cops feel bad just because the other 99%.
You know, I'd honestly say it's about 30% of them are decent. But I also know personally some cops that are completely pure bully. They just, they enjoy pushing people around.
Your number has like two figures in it. It's excessive.
He's in Canada, though. He's in Canada.
Oh, that, yeah, well, I understand that. Yeah. Now it gets more clear, you know, for me. So I challenge you on that. I would say that bullying doesn't come from weakness. If you were interested, you can, you know, hear me. What do you think? So I think that bullying is nothing but the obvious and logical, even if it's not ethical. It's the obvious and logical reaction to the sick society that we live in, right? And yes, of course, there's an element about weakness and there's an element about strength. There's an element of strength and there's an element of weakness in bullying. But I think it comes, it's generated by abusive people, right? A kid is not naturally abusive to others until he has been shown through example that abuse works to get what he wants. Then he sees it in his household, right? Because he understands this fundamentally, that when he is doing something and his parents want him to stop, or that he is not doing something that his parents want him to do, their parents will they'll bully him in various ways, verbally or physically, into getting him to do or don't do what he is supposed to not do or do, right? And at the same time, then the kid goes to school and sees the same goddamn pattern from his teachers
and from
the authorities, right?
It's not weakness, it's powerlessness. Now, if you love your child, you build up their ego, and you might be a disciplinarian, okay? Like, rules, they need stability. But if you build them up on the inside, and they feel strong and powerful, or they're not going to need to demonstrate that they're strong by bullying somebody else. But our whole present system takes the kids that are like that and tells them that you're bad for being dominant. It equates dominance with bullying when they're completely separate things.
And it also equates being weak for being bad, right? Like, powerlessness and powerfulness are both, in a way, in a manner of speaking, and in actual literal ways, the schools and the parents, they both resort to the easy way of resolving, I put that into, you know, between quotes, resolving conflict by punishing the bullied and the bully, right? If the bully tries to defend himself from the bully, or the bully attacks a bullied and then he defends himself, right? Then that creates a conflict. And of course, schools don't want that and parents don't want that. They just want their kids to shut the fuck up, and they want the kids to continue to go to class and not create a conflict that will, you know, reflect poorly on the school.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, this bullying obsession, it's about the conflict. Like, there's that Australian kid that beat up he body slammed the guy that bullied him.
That was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how you deal with a bully. That kid is an alpha male. Even if he's a bit chubby right now, he's an alpha male. And it obsesses over that. When that's how you stop bullying, is you let kids defend themselves. Like, the good kids will defend themselves if you let them. But instead, you take the good kids that will never use violence. Like, they've never started a fight. You take the good kid and say, violence is always wrong. You should be ashamed for hating a bully. You need to love everybody. And so they don't defend themselves. And so the bullies run rampant.
They feed on that. They feed on it because what I've seen, of course, is that bullies, first, of course, you know, Rhoda's right. They have terrible home lives for the most part. They're victims of bullying, and they use that as what they do is they create this mental construct of how people are supposed to interact in a dominant people are supposed to interact to create dominant power, which is they use force to achieve dominance because that's what's used on them. So universalization, that's what I was trying to come up with that word. Mm-hmm. They universalize the violence under them, and they do that by projecting that onto other people through bullying.
So the whole conflict resolution thing, right, it teaches kids two lessons. The first lesson is, if you're a bully and you manage to get away with bullying, that's cool. And the second lesson, this is like the most pernicious lesson. If you are a victim of bullying, instead of resolving the problem by resorting to the most immediate and effective mechanism, which is self-defense, right? We're talking about kids who can actually use self-defense but don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're afraid of authority. The lesson that these kids get taught is, you know what? If you self-defense, we're going to punish you. You're supposed to go to your authorities and report him so nothing is done and you are fucked. And that is what little kids learn, right? Imagine how perverse
society. Right? We don't want a society of strong people and strong family, confident, and don't need to phone the cops all the time. We want a society where everybody's collecting welfare, everybody's phoning the cops, and everybody's scared and broken inside.
Welcome to modern society.
I can't wait for it to collapse.
Oh, God. I hear you, man.
Yeah, no, I can't agree more with anything that's been said in the last, like, 15 minutes. It's been a fantastic discussion on this stuff. I just wanted to mention that we have 2 minutes left, so we're running really low on time.
I think Bizarro mode is in order.
Yeah,
I think two things out.
Sure.
If you're interested in the novel, it's on Facebook. I'm keeping a like page updated as I walk these broken roads. Facebook.com as I walk these broken roads, or go check out Amazon. I'm sure it's on there as well since they're selling it. Ebook is out. Print will be soon.
And, is it going to be hardcover or soft cover?
It's going to be soft cover. Yeah. Okay. I'd love to do a hardcover at some point, but for now it's just soft cover.
What's the price point of the novel?
Oh, yes, obviously. It is $5.99 for the ebook and $9.49 for the soft cover. And if you're wondering, I make more money off the ebook.
That does not surprise me these days. I read everything on my Kindle. It's awesome.
You know, it's expensive to print books. They weigh a lot.
And you have to transport them. And you have to
exactly.
Yeah. And you kill trees, man. You got to save the environment, man.
Trees!
In the spirit of that question, Orini, I'm going to ask you to go full Bizarro now. Now you have to tell us the best, absolute best and most convincing, and you get to define best and most convincing here, argument against everything that you stand for. Go ahead.
Ooh, boy. Yeah, you know what? The thing is that we're just ignorant, hate-filled primitives that want to go back to some sort of like monkey society where we all kill each other with bricks and stones. We celebrate rape and controlling women because we have weakness inside of ourselves. That's why we say that women are actually happier being a housewife than a 40-year-old HR representative with a cat named after a gangster. It's because we are weak inside. We need to control women. We are violent people, and we should be eliminated.
Ouch. All right.
I've heard that last one quite a bit. People who are just like, you know what? Humans really suck. We should just kill ourselves. Like, you can be the first one. Lead the way. Lead by example.
Lead, follow, or get out of the way.
That'll probably get me arrested in today's society. I should say that on there.
Oh. You know, we might be more economically free in Canada, but I'm pretty sure I've broken at least 3 speech laws in the past hour.
Well,
no, don't
we'll
worry. I'm sure we're on some watch list.
Here. Hell yeah.
Oh, bring it, Human Rights Tribunal.
All right, well, I think we're out of time for the main show today. So, Ron, you want to take us out?
Yes, unfortunately. I think it's about that time. So, my aggressively non-aggressive friends, this is Ron McPaul here. And to be honest, I almost wasn't able to just sit back and listen because you guys covered a lot of interesting ground. And Arini brings a lot of good perspectives to help, which helps the declined estate become a better organization.
Don't forget to mention the website and the YouTubes.
Yes, for Arini, we definitely encourage the check out the book. I think if we can get our technology in order, we should be able to get a link up on the DTS page. And definitely check out the Arini's channel on YouTube. I would like to remind you that Declined Estate is still brought to you free of charge, as well as commercial free. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, and of course, Arini. And Declined Estate is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles.
It's so great to be here, guys.
When asked, always Declined Estate. Yeah, thanks very much, Arini. This is Ron McPaul, wishing all of you a lovely rest of your night.
And this is Roto. Eternal, take us off.
Yeah, this is Eternal, and just for you guys, just one more time, check out Rini's site at staresattheworld.com, and also go to youtube.com/Arini. That's spelled A-U-R-I-N-I. Just making sure you guys...
Arini, Delta Mike Juliet, DMJ.
Delta Mike Juliet? Oh, Arini DMJ, that's what the YouTube is?
Affirmative.
Okay, awesome.
10-4.
Yeah, have... thanks for coming on the show, everybody. It's been a great time. I guess everybody stick around for the after show after this, and we can take your calls and have a good time. All right. Have a great night, everyone.
I had a blast.